This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orange County Sheriff Jerry Demings made a plea to the community to help prevent violent crime, like the shooting that claimed the lives of five people on Monday. Brenda Montanez Crespo, Robert Snyder, Kevin Lawson, Jeffrey Roberts and Kevin Clark were killed at the Orlando awning factory where they worked before the shooter turned the gun on himself. Authorities ruled out terrorism in their investigation. On today's show, we'll talk about the differences in how law enforcement, the community and the media respond to violent crimes that are classified as terrorism and crimes that aren't. Meanwhile, how has the on-the-ground response of law enforcement to mass shootings changed? And what's the role of the media in getting information out there and in helping law enforcement solve these crimes? And what about the role of social media? Does it help or hinder? We're taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252. We're also on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio is Vince Citro. He's a former federal prosecutor specialised in national security and counterterrorism. He's now an attorney with Mark Horwitz, PA in Orlando. Thanks for joining us, Vince.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by Will Kennelly. He's an associate professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida. Will, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And joining us from Tampa is former FBI special agent Dave Cuvatier. He's now a consultant on crime prevention, personal safety, and active shooter preparedness and media crisis management and communications. Dave, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Matt.
Dave, I want to start with you. When does the FBI get involved in investigating shooting incidents? Does it depend on the scope and the scale of the incident? How does that work?
Well, nowadays, because of all the different issues that have been occurring between terrorism and active shooter situations, years ago, not only the FBI, but the local authorities have now worked together and teamed up to actually respond more efficiently and effectively to minimize any of these impacts. So it's been something that's developed over the last several years where FBI automatically will respond with their the other agencies, the partners in the other agencies, and then once everyone has an assessment of what's going on, a better understanding, and then delegation is done accordingly. And if the FBI has to step back out, they will do that and go more into a support role. Or if they need to jump in and lead an investigation, they do that as well.
So you're saying that you would see FBI agents on the scene of a crime like what happened on Monday on Orlando more soon than you would have in the past?
Oh, it's automatic, especially nowadays where over the last several years, we coexist, or the FBI actually has task force agents actually working out of FBI offices as well. Mm-hmm. So when something like that comes across the radio or notification comes in, everyone in law enforcement in that particular community is now basically notified at the same time and responds accordingly.
Right. What about the response on the ground to mass shooting incidents? How has that changed since you started in the FBI?
It has dramatically changed. Again, it goes partially because of the increase, the statistical increase in studies that have shown that active shooter situations have becoming a dynamic now that society hears about almost on a daily basis, unfortunately. And then, of course, on top of that, we have the situation that we're dealing with on terrorism as well.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's the number. We're talking about the differences between mass shootings and crimes that are classified as terrorism, how the law enforcement, how the public, how the media responds to those issues. We'd like to hear from you as well. 1-866-338-5252. Is terrorism the first thing that springs to mind when you hear news of a shooting? Thinking back to that scare at Orlando International Airport last week, or, of course, the shooting at Fort Lauderdale International Airport earlier this year, back in January. We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can send us a tweet, too. We're over on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Vince Citro, I want to bring you on this conversation. Just give us a quick refresher. How do you define terror from a criminal investigation point of view?
Well, when it comes to the FBI, as Dave said, they are really working hand in glove with local law enforcement, and the Department of Justice is doing that same thing with the FBI. So just like the FBI starts off with employing people into these mass shooting situations and getting people on the ground and involved, the Department of Justice is working hand in glove in those situations as well.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to bring in prosecutors who have experience with the national security tools and training on how to use national security information, as well as people who have training doing criminal investigations. Generally, if you're doing national security work, you've already built up a pretty robust resume and depth of experience in criminal work. And so we see where the evidence is going. We try to help in the collection of evidence, whether it's supporting the FBI and getting search warrants or orders from internet service providers so that we can get the information to the Bureau or the appropriate investigative agency in order to determine, was this something that was a terrorist event or was this a traditionally more domestic criminal event?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes a little while to sort out those facts, doesn't it?
No investigation really works the same. They're all unique. They're all got factors as part of them that you'll parse through as you parse through and come to the right conclusion.
Mm-hmm. What about the public's response? Because the minute you label something an act of terror, you're going to get a lot more public scrutiny on that. So does that complicate things for law enforcement and for prosecutors having more eyes on it?
For prosecutors, no. What the public perceives is not something we can really be bogged down with. We're going to have to do what we always do, which is protect the constitutional rights of individuals and at the same time protect public safety. So it's not going to affect the steps that we would take, the conversations that we would have with the FBI, or the legal processes that we would approach the court with in order to gather evidence.
Mm-hmm. Will Kennelly, I want to bring you on this conversation. Will Kennelly, Associate Professor of Journalism at UCF. I mean, are we at a moment of heightened awareness of terror, do you think? We're of course, approaching the one-year anniversary of the shooting at Pulse. We had that event last week at Orlando International Airport. Resolved peacefully eventually. Even a suspicious vehicle at the airport fairly recently, too. A lot of drama around that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, certainly for those folks of us here in Orlando, the idea of terrorism is on the tip of our minds, right? We are thinking about it because we are still talking about Pulse, certainly around the anniversary. Mm-hmm. We are thinking about it from the standpoint of the actions that happened in London. So when something like the attack in the awning store happens, we are always going to be thinking initially about the idea of potentially a terrorist attack. And from the media perspective, you're talking about the law enforcement perspective and wanting to know, what is this? Mm-hmm. The media want to know, too, what is this? Because they tell the story differently. There's a different approach to telling what happened if it's a terrorist attack than if it's a shooting as it was. Mm-hmm. Because now we're thinking about the victims differently. We're thinking about, in a crime, the victims as being the people who were injured or killed in that incident. When we're thinking about terrorist attack, we're thinking about those folks, but we're also thinking about us nationally as being victims. So the story is told differently because we perceive the victim differently as well. Mm-hmm.
Do you think the approach of the media in responding or reporting on mass shootings in general has changed? Like, do you think there is more attention now being paid to trying to paint a full picture of who the people were who were killed or injured?
Well, certainly there is an attempt to tell the stories of the people who were victims in both cases. What seems to be different is the way in which they tell the stories of the people who were the perpetrators. And when it comes to the folks who are engaged in terrorist acts, things that we identify later as being terrorist activities, we describe their backgrounds differently than people who are committing crimes such as these mass murders, where the interest is in more on what is their religious background, what is their community background. When it comes to someone who is committing a crime or is a perpetrator of a crime, we are finding out more about them, but from the perspective of mental illness. Mm-hmm. Something went wrong with this individual, and it led to this action. And so the story is told differently, and our attention to the different people involved is different from the media perspective as well.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about crime, violent crime and terror, and the kind of interaction between the two. And whether you think of terror the first time you hear reports of a mass shooting or a violent crime, we're at 1-866-338-5252. I'd like to hear what's on your mind. You can send us a tweet to at WMFE Orlando. Dave Cuvertier, when did the question of whether a crime is an act of terror become one of the more routine questions that is on the minds of law enforcement? Like, when did that happen?
I think, it used to be a situation where we thought about or we discussed terrorism. If something happened overseas, it happened in a different country. Once 9/11 occurred, that really brought it home, and it resonated with the entire nation.
Mm-hmm. Now, you run active shooter presentations. What's changed in how you advise people to respond now versus what you might have told people a few decades ago?
Oh, everything. When I give those workshops, we go from the traditional response of law enforcement. For example, it used to be, and as a former SWAT operator as well, we would respond to these type of incidents where we had a barricaded subject or an incident that had that was involving a weapon of some type or violence, we would actually get there, contain, and just hold the crime scene, mm-hmm. not go in necessarily right away, and try to start negotiations, and we try to protract the situation to get some time to talk to the hostage taker or the individual that's barricaded inside that particular residence or facility. After, the Columbine High School shooting incident, and law enforcement actually started taking a look at these type of situations in a different way. Now, and this is one of the things I really touch on, the big difference now is that first responder officers now have to go in because of the change in the threat. It's no longer somebody trying to hold the position or hold hostages to negotiate something that they want. Now they're going in with the intention of just killing as many people as they can, as quickly as they can, before law enforcement arrives. So now they have that dynamic where law enforcement, the first responder, sometimes just one officer alone, they're trained now to actually go in and try to neutralize the threat, because if you sit and wait, that individual has an opportunity to kill additional individuals. The other psychological issue that I teach is to let people know that the initial response, if you're shot or hurt in a situation like that, that law enforcement is going to walk right past you and continue looking for the threat. Mm-hmm. And that's psychologically something that folks have to get prepared for, but knowing that there's a second wave of coming that are going to provide EMTs and tactical medics to get to them. But the priority now is to get to that shooter and shut them down.
What about the idea of making sure that you're not identified as the shooter yourself if you're a victim? I mean, is that something you go over in discussing these scenarios with your clients?
Oh, absolutely. And I also let them know that to have confidence in law enforcement, because the last several years, there's been a national push, mostly led by the FBI, where training for law enforcement officers has come into play. And specifically the issues you're talking about is when you have a situation like that, you're going to have officers from different departments wearing different uniforms. You're going to have plainclothes detectives that may hear the call come over the radio. You're going to have federal agents and other entities coming to assist. So there are protocols that I let them know in basic terms. I don't want to give everything away because that's law enforcement sensitive to the operation. Mm-hmm. Those are things that we do talk about.
Vince Citro, just thinking about the response and how law enforcement has kind of changed its tactics a little bit in the way they respond to these things. I mean, do you see that too in the role of prosecutors? Would you see now maybe a prosecutor on scene sooner than they might have been there at an incident like this in the past?
Absolutely. With the various incidents that have occurred throughout the United States, the Department of Justice has continued to learn from those past experiences and adapt. So now you, in addition to having what the FBI has, that is someone whose job it is in the local U.S. Attorney's Office to be a coordinator of all the agencies that have a counterterrorism or national security mission, there's someone in that office whose job it is to answer the phone when it rings in the middle of the night as a result of one of these incidents taking place. Mm-hmm. They're going to be immediately in the command center having discussions not only with the local agents, the chiefs, the sheriffs, but they're also going to be having discussions with their headquarters component up in Washington, D.C. And so you're going to see prosecutors more involved sooner so that legal process can go out quicker in order to get the information to the decision makers.
So the job description's changed a little bit.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. What about social media? Because that's now kind of an evidence stream, right? You're looking at what somebody who might be involved in one of these incidents has posted on social media. That's kind of changed the game too a little bit.
Indeed, it has. And prosecutors, just like agents, are looking at what is available on the public social media. They are looking at what information they can get using various legal processes from the accounts, from the internet service provider, from the social media host, or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Will Canelli, talk about how that social media picture has changed the game too for reporters, because it's kind of speeded things up as far as the reporting process, getting information out there. You no longer have so much time to kind of think about things and digest the information before trying to get more information out there. How has that changed the game for reporters and journalists?
Well, certainly for reporters, it makes a big difference from a couple of perspectives. One, everybody's battling to get the information out there first as quickly as possible. And then two, they have to figure out what is accurate. And that becomes a huge challenge in social media. And they don't necessarily have the time to review the information that's coming at them. And there's that desire to have information filling the airwaves or filling the news space. And so that puts puts the reporters in a very challenging position, because it's not easy to validate the information that's coming across, say, Twitter. There may be some information that's very accurate. I'm sure the folks in the legal world and police approach think the same way. It's like, well, what here is something we can work with? Mm-hmm. And that is something that, you know, is hugely challenging, and it's not going to change. In fact, there's a program that used to be on the station here at WMFE called On the Media, and they had a little guide that included information about, you know, social media. Discount anything in social media, because more than likely it's not correct until later on. Give it time. And so the reporters have to worry about being in that role of sending out information that's incorrect, and also be aware of the fact that they've got to try to figure out better ways of identifying what is accurate information.
Do you see, is there kind of some kind of conflict between trying to get the story and trying to make sure you don't, you know, necessarily like overly complicate a situation that's already fairly dangerous?
Yeah, I think that that's something that reporters have to struggle with, that they are in a mode where there is the constant pressure to get information out to serve their audiences. And that's an area where the audience is important. Their perceptions of what you're doing are very important. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they have to recognize that they're in the middle of this situation that is going to affect the information they provide, could affect what's happening from the police perspective. And so it's a fine line to walk for them, for sure.
Vince Citro, do you think there's more of an overlap now between violent crime and terrorism? Is it always a clear-cut distinction?
I don't know that there's any more overlap than there historically has been throughout, quite frankly, the world's history. I think what you've got now is a situation where the department, both through its law enforcement arms as well as its prosecutor arms, approaching violent situations, understanding this could be a national security threat or this could be a traditional criminal matter. And so we need to approach it with people who are trained in both, and so that when we make that determination, we have people who are involved with the necessary training and tools to handle it appropriately.
Mm-hmm. What about the notion of terrorism? I'm wondering, if we overuse that word, does the public kind of become numb to that, do you think?
That's sort of an interesting question. I did move back to Central Florida until the end of August 2016. Up until then, I was working in the nation's capital with, quite frankly, some of the most skilled litigators and brightest legal minds in the department in the counterterrorism section. So we live this day in and day out. Moving back to Central Florida, and maybe as the result of the things that Central Florida has experienced, I've been very impressed to see that it's not been numbed in the minds of the general public, especially with reports like this or discussions like this that are so important to get out to keep the public aware that there is a legitimate threat and there are ways that we need to deal with it living in these communities while safeguarding our own liberty.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that real quick, Will Cannelli? Do you think that phrase, that label can be overused, and does that sort of make people less likely to pay attention to it?
Well, certainly the language that's used to describe these events is important and affects the way people perceive, you know, opportunities, policies that might be put in place in order to deal with the issues. So the idea of labeling something terrorism, I think, in and of itself certainly has an effect on the way people perceive what's happening here. But I think that some of the other language that is used around it has a greater impact. The idea that we use the language war on terror, mm-hmm. that implies a military approach, which may or may not be the best approach to deal with the issue, but it frames the idea in that concept of a military activity.
Will Cannelli is a professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida. Will, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Also joined by Vince Citro, former federal prosecutor, now an attorney in Orlando. Vince, thank you for joining us as well.
Pleasure is mine.
And Dave Cuvertier, former FBI special agent, now consults on security, active shooter scenarios, and crisis management. Dave, thank you so much as well.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a true pleasure.
Up next, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum is running for governor. How much common ground does he have with his fellow Democratic contenders? Conversation with Andrew Gillum coming up when we return. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Andrew Gillum is the mayor of Tallahassee. He's a Democrat, and he announced his campaign for governor back in March. He says the next governor will have to tackle challenges like climate change, improving the state's healthcare and education system, and creating good jobs for Floridians. But he says don't compare his jobs campaign to Governor Scott's.
The governor says he's the jobs governor, but he doesn't tell us that the jobs that he's focused on and that he recruits to the state are largely low-wage jobs. Roughly 45% of the people in this state, the working adults in this state, are working jobs, and they can't make their months in obligation. They can't make ends meet from month to month. They're trading between cutoff dates and which bills to pay. And so when I talk about jobs, I'm talking about jobs and jobs with dignity, jobs that come with benefits, jobs that pay wages that are respectable and ones that you can take care of yourselves and your family. The truth is in this state, we have shrunk from, I think, one of the best opportunities we have, and that is to reinfuse into our ninth grade through 12th grade system the trades, pipeline jobs, what it means to have, you know, a skill in plumbing and mechanical and electrical and woodwork and shop. I don't know about you, but I had a plumber at my house, and the bill came out to over $300, and it was an hour and a half of work. You know, we have made those jobs taboo, and the truth is that there's a real need for them. My wife and I just had a baby a few weeks ago, and the nurse who helped us in the delivery was a traveling nurse who came from Ponte Vedra Beach over to Tallahassee to help in that process. So we've got a shortage in that space.
If I could just burst in there for a moment, though, Mayor Gillum, I mean, is the idea of attracting high-wage jobs, do you want to focus on those things like, you know, the trade level, or do you want to try and bolster higher education in the kind of engineering, you know, mathematics field, the sort of higher sciences?
Listen, I think you have to do it all. And where I think the critique is that we have completely neglected prioritizing what it means to get to equip people with the skills that they need, frankly, for the jobs that exist today. And I'll give you one example. In my city, we were acknowledged by the Obama administration as a tech hire community because of the work that we're doing to try to meet the challenge of training this generation of workers for the technical related jobs that exist today. And the truth is that these tech jobs are not jobs where they're looking for engineers or mathematicians. They're looking for people who, quite frankly, may not even have a bachelor's degree that come in with a core competency around some of the back end and the front end of technology and are willing to then go into these jobs, get a little bit more training. And these are jobs that pay good wages, right? And so our hyper-emphasis on college only has, in my opinion, forced us to neglect the real economy out there that exists, good-paying jobs for folks who just need a skill that they can then monetize and go to work and make a good living for themselves and their families.
Well, education spending, if you look at this legislative session in 2017, that's been a bit of a sticking point for the legislature. Do you think Florida is spending enough on education? And if not, what should they be spending on it?
Well, I first of all, we're 50th out of 50th in per pupil spending. So I think there's a pretty clear answer that we're not where we need to be when it comes to spending. But what we should be looking for are levels of effectiveness. I mean, I believe in equity funding of education, which means everybody doesn't get a dollar. Everybody gets what they need. Different environments require different tools in the toolbox in order to make sure that we're able to lift our children into an educational environment and create an opportunity to learn for our state's youth. I believe that our state's education system needs a serious redress. I mean, our addiction to high-stakes testing, these tests don't tell us what our kids know. They tell us how well they take a test. And so we need to redress that. We've got to reinfuse trade back into the system. We need to obviously address the teacher pay inequities that exist in this state. You've now got teacher shortages. You've got teachers who are resigning from the field. We've made it an unattractive place to go. The Speaker of the House refers to our educational institutions, the K-12 system, as failure factories.
Well, to be fair, I mean, it's only some of them that are failure factories. I don't think every single school, and I don't think the Speaker said that every single school is a failure factory.
I think what we should be doing instead of calling them names are figuring out what do we have to do to go into those systems and make them work, make them operational, right? And that includes not just what happens inside the classroom, which is why this idea of wraparound schools One that I would reference that you all know well down there is Evans High School down in Orlando, where what you got is a community school concept that is addressing more than just what happens in the classroom. You're actually seeing these young people as complete and full individuals. And the results that you're seeing there, where you've got graduation rates, you've got folks pipelining not only into college but also into career. I'd like to see us producing more of that in this state, but you certainly don't get kids to feel good about themselves. You certainly don't incent them to learn when all you're doing is placing F grades on them, calling them failure factories, pushing kids out of the school system, not paying teachers adequately, in fact, disincentivizing some of your best trained teaching professionals from going into difficult teaching environments, because if they go there and that school doesn't receive annual yearly progress, you debit the salary of those teachers. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, a wrong-headed approach to incentives. It's a disincentive. How about you say, if you go into the most difficult and most challenging teaching environments, we're going to give you bonuses, right? We're going to give you wages that are at a higher level because of the difficult circumstances that you're encountering by going into those environments. That, in my opinion, is a way that you get schools to lift up, not by calling them names.
Well, I want to just pick up on something that you were asked at a meeting with the Puerto Rican Leadership Council down here in Orlando this week. You know, one of the questions was, if you're elected governor of Florida, you're going to be working with a legislature that's largely Republican. How are you going to get them on side, whether it's for education, whether it's for some of the issues that you're pushing for to see improvements in?
Well, a divided Democrat and Republican government might be exactly what is the order of the day. I mean, you right now have Republicans in control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion, and I have never seen more dysfunction in Tallahassee. You've got a special session that is about to blow up. And by the way, you only have a special session because these members, these Republicans, largely under their leadership, couldn't get the one job done that they're sent to Tallahassee to do for 2 months, which is to produce a budget for this state, right? They couldn't get that job done, so they're back here in Tallahassee. So what I would suggest, firstly, our state probably could use a little bit of divided government so that we can search ourselves to figure out where the grounds of commonality where we can agree to move this state forward. I actually believe that there are probably Republicans who would agree that, you know what, we've abandoned the trades, we've abandoned the investments or shrunk from the investments in our community college system, and we ought to get at that again. Or maybe we say, you know what, the infrastructure in this state is not as updated and not as sophisticated as the third largest state in all of America ought to have. Mm-hmm. Let's make investments in high-speed rail that move people between the major population centers of this state, from St. Petersburg to Tampa, from Tampa to Orlando, and then eventually from Orlando downstate, right? Because roads beget more traffic. Traffic begets more headache. And most people are frustrated up and down this state about that.
Well, how would you pay for that though? Where would you get the revenue to pay for some of those big infrastructure projects?
It's a great question. So let's acknowledge first that we had an opportunity when President Obama tried to send $2.4 billion to the state of Florida to assist us in that journey. We had a governor who was so philosophically oriented that he said, "No, we don't take stimulus money." Never mind that Florida sends more money to Washington, D.C. than what we bring down. Mm-hmm. So it's got to happen in partnership with the federal government.
Right. But do you get the sense, Mayor Gillum, that this federal government would be in the mood to send some money the way of Florida or other states to pay for something like that?
If we take the president at his word yesterday, and I know there's a lot in the conversation with regard to this president, the least of which were his comments around infrastructure. But should this president be serious about making infrastructure investments in this country? As a mayor of this city and certainly as this state's governor, I would love to meet him for that challenge to invest. I mean, I think this president practically ran on a campaign of the crumbling infrastructure of this country. So if we're to take him at his word, and I've heard plenty of Democrats talk about the need to do this, there is public will between both parties to make those kinds of investments. But we can't have a governor of this state who says, "I don't believe in stimulus and therefore I won't take federal money." Mm-hmm. That's a non-starter. So I think we got to begin by saying, you know what, this is money that belongs in this state. This state needs to update its infrastructure. We got to address transportation in this state. And so we're going to accept those dollars, and we're going to lobby hard for those dollars. So I actually don't think that's such a foregone thought. Mm-hmm. It seems imminently accessible.
So what's next for you as far as the campaign goes? It's a pretty crowded field on the Democratic side. Are you confident that you stand out from the other candidates running on that Democratic ticket?
I am confident. We have made tremendous strides just in the little while that we have been in this race. I believe that we're going to win back the governor's mansion, and I believe I'll be the candidate at the top of the ticket in 2018 to help deliver that win for the state of Florida, not just for Democrats. Because who loses when we lose these elections are everyday people, the 1.5 million medically needy who didn't get access to health care. The folks who are attending our public schools and being referred to as failure factories, our teachers who are being referred to as evil. It is the folks who live in South Florida and in all parts of the state who have been negatively impacted by sea level rise that floods their streets, or algae blooms, which have flown out the east and the west side of this state of a guacamole content. Those are the folks who lose when we lose elections. And so we're running this race because we believe that everyday folks in this state deserve a voice in the process as well. And I'll tell you, we've got more individual donors than any other campaign out there running. I realize that I got to do this the old-fashioned way. Our average contributions hover around $20. And so I'm moving all across the state. This is an expensive state. It's a big state. But when I first ran for the city commission in Tallahassee, I didn't have much money then either. And I whittled my way through a 7-way race down to a 2-person race and ultimately won that election, becoming the youngest person in Tallahassee's history to serve on the city commission. So I'm used to people telling me what I can't do. But I am energized, and the folks that we're encountering are energized around this race. And I feel confident that we're going to do what's required in order to win the Democratic nomination and then win this state come November of 2018.
Andrew Gillum, mayor of Tallahassee and candidate for Florida governor, thank you so much for your time.
Matthew, thank you so much. God bless.
Still to come on Intersection.
We try to find things that they know the lyrics to, usually. They may not know every lyric, but at least they'll go, oh, I know that song.
Via Electric, a string quintet that rocks. That's when we return. If you missed an episode of Intersection, check out our podcast. You can find that on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. You can also find us on the NPR One app. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Via Electric is a Central Florida band that plays rock music on classical stringed instruments. They joined us in studio for a set and spoke to 90.7's Brendan Byrne. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Brendan Byrne. In the studio here with me is Vialectric, and I'm speaking with the founder, Michelle Jones. Michelle Jones, thanks for joining us.
Thank you again for having us, Brendan. We appreciate it.
So what are we looking at here? Explain to our listeners, who do we have here in the studio?
Oh, we have a full rock band. We have quite a few. Everything is acoustic, of course, except for our keys, because we try to have as organic a sound as possible. So we have with us two violins, viola, cello, upright, bass, keys, and drums.
Okay. And can you quickly introduce us to them?
Absolutely. Well, my name is Michelle Jones. I'm violin. Then we have Lexi Parsons on second violin.
Hello.
Then we have Caitlin Higby on the viola part.
Hello.
Camden Dumas on the cello.
Cello.
Paul Cuevas on the upright bass, who's also our principal arranger.
Hey there.
Carol Hensel on keys.
Hello.
And, of course, Bobby Del Vecchio on the drum kit.
Peace.
So what goes into picking a song that would be good for this kind of group here?
The main thing we listen for is, number one, would people recognize it if we played it?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many wonderful pieces out there. Unfortunately, they're not very well known.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find something that most people have been singing in the car for 20-plus years.
Or the shower, right?
Or the shower. and you know, all these. We try to find things that they know the lyrics to, usually. They may not know every lyric, but at least they'll go, oh, I know that song.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sing along. Like, they know Kashmir, even if they don't know necessarily the name of it, but they've heard that song. And they're like, they sing it. They know that riff. They know the rhythm. It's very recognizable.
Do you ever notice people walk into a club or a concert you're playing and they see you all and they don't really pay attention? They do a double take and they're like, wait a minute, is that a Zeppelin song I'm hearing?
That's exactly what happens. And then what's funny, we were at an event one time where we were doing a concert. And so we were playing, and these people, they come up during the intermission and say, well, who was your vocalist?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there was no vocalist. If you heard somebody, you heard somebody singing next to you or something, but you there's no vocalist in our group. And they said, really? And that's when we realized, oh, okay, we let the audience supply it.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that it's twice as engaging to the brain when there's not a vocalist, because now they're going, hey, I recognize that song. And then they start engaging a part of their brain, which
mm-hmm.
now makes them an active listener as opposed to a passive listener. And that's what we really love to do.
You hear some of the intricacies in the original arrangement when you play on a different instrument, right?
Definitely. When we're tearing it apart, and I do some of the arranging as well, so when I'm tearing it apart, I'm listening again for what are the key parts. Well, then what is this gorgeous harmony that's going on top of it? And, oh, wow, look at that. There's like this little flourish in the background, and we want to make sure that gets captured. And basically we're dissecting every song down to the most minute detail, mixing it up, rearranging it for our instrumentation so that everything can be played live. We do not use backing tracks. We do not use pre-recorded sounds. We do not use anything. It has to be done live and organically.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to lead us in next? What song are you playing?
Oh, definitely a little James Bond music, Adele Skyfall.
Take it away. You're listening to Intersection here on 90.7 News. I'm Brendan Byrne in the studio via Electric here. I'm speaking with the group's founder, Michelle Jones. Now, Michelle, is there a song that that you listen to that you have yet to transpose into the group here that you'd like to?
Oh, there's about 10 million of those, I think. So we have a list and we keep going. But we, again, it takes time to dissect it and arrange it. And then it takes time, once it is arranged, for all of our musicians to memorize it, because everything we play is memorized.
Yeah, I don't see any music stands in here.
No, there's no music stands. Everything is memorized. Everything is rehearsed. And that's what also makes it different, is we don't have that barrier between us and the audience of, when you think of a string quartet, you think, oh, they're sitting, they have the music stands, and they're staring at their music. With us, no. There's no stands. There's no barrier between us and the audience. We're making eye contact with the audience. We're going out in the audience because we are wirelessly amplified. Mm-hmm. And we love getting out and dancing with the guests in the aisles, especially at shows. It's just a lot of fun. But that's the challenge behind it, is making sure everything is memorized and well enough that we can interact with our guests. That we're not having to go, oh, wait, where's that verse? Oh, wait, where's that chorus? So we have to have it so well rehearsed. And right now we have approximately 6 hours of uninterrupted continuous music. Not that we play that long, but we have about that much. But we keep adding every month. We usually try to add two or three new songs.
Well, Michelle Jones is the founder of Vi-Electric. Thank you all so much for coming in. Would you mind playing us one more song before you go?
Oh, I think you'll recognize this, and I hope you'll headbang with us too.
Thank you.
You're listening to Vi-Electric performing Bohemian Rhapsody. You can find out more about the band on our website, wmfe.org, and Vi-Electric will perform as part of Orlando United Day on Monday. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. This week's show was produced by Abe Abariah. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Talia Blake. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Amy Green answered the phones. If you missed an episode of Intersection, download the podcast. You can find that on iTunes, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.